the Financial Sense Midweek Edition with Jim Poplava. Delving in-depth with authors and experts into the key economic issues.
Everyone, I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of Lifetime Income. A lot of things we're going to be discussing on the program today. I'll let John tell you a little bit about that, and a special guest coming on as we take a look at healthcare and other issues related to it.
Greetings, everybody. I'm John Loeffler, and today Jim's guest is going to be Dr. Greg Sperber, who is an acupuncturist. He's also an author and dean of the College of Eastern Medicine at the Southern California University School of Health Sciences. And we'll be discussing the fact that, well, you know, as you get a little older, parts of your body start to ache a little more than they did, you know.
Really?
Yeah, they do. Your body begins to break down, and you discover, I can break. You know, when you were young, you were going to live forever, right? Okay, but now you discover, well, that's not going to happen, but I want to keep this machine going as long as I can, and one of the processes to do that is to alleviate pain, and he'll be discussing the use of acupuncture as a means of alleviating pain, integrating it into traditional Western medicine in that area.
And today we're going to be talking about your money, and we're going to approach that topic from one of not just making it, but how to make it. And it's going to determine how you invest and save. Now, and also, it'll relate to your potential of reaching your retirement goals. Essentially, what are your attitudes toward money? Are you a conservative, cautious investor? Or are you more of the aggressive type, more concerned with accumulation and making wealth rather than conserving it? Or maybe you're somewhere in between. Now, a lot of this may seem insignificant to you, but it's a very important process in the decisions in how you invest, how you save, and your chances for success in reaching your retirement goals.
Well, I know since the second bear market and the financial crisis, investors' attitudes towards risk have changed. We've certainly seen it in the emails that come into Financial Sense. I've run into it when I talk to people at the gym. The first thing is they ask, where can I put my money? Because, well, you know what happened back then. And I'll say, well, right now we've had a bull market in stocks, and they go, ooh. So it sort of follows that conversation. Where do you put your money? Right now stocks are a good place. Ooh. But that could change again. Let's face it.
Let me ask you this. Yeah. Are you still getting that as much as, let's say, a couple of years ago? Because I know we used to talk about some of your stories at the gym where a lot of people were just, everybody was expecting the big one. The dollar was going to collapse with quantitative easing. The stock market was going to collapse. Forget it, went nowhere for 13 years. But you used to get a lot of that. Are you getting that as much as, let's say, you used to?
Not as much, but when you bring it up, it'll be there. You know, before people, they wanted to make money, but they were afraid to make a move. It's a very classic scenario that you described, but it's not as much. And I'm not sure why, whether they've sobered up to that or just sort of moved on in their lives. And, you know, in some cases, people resign themselves to the way things are and say, well, that's it. Nothing much I can do about it. And let's face it, Jim, that could all change again. There's going to be, we're in what, phase two of this bull market? You hit phase three, everything can flip over, and then there's a time that you need to get out.
Yeah, and I really expect by the time we get to phase three, John, everybody's going to talk about how much they're making in the market. Who knows what the next craze in the market is. But, you know, one of the things that we have talked about here on the program, probably one of the most influential books on investing, it really shaped Warren Buffett's life and really shaped his career, is The Intelligent Investor. And it was written by Ben Graham, and I think it's probably one of the best investment books out there. And one of the things that Graham tries to do in this book, and I would recommend, there are copies out there. It's been updated by Jason Zweig, and I really recommend you pick up a copy. Warren Buffett reads it every single year. I read it every single year. It's a good reminder. But what Graham tried to do in his book is get the investor to think of who they were as an investor. In other words, are you an investor or really are you a speculator? And more important to know the difference between the two, when you're speculating or when you're investing. And it sounds very simple, but John, the principles are seldom mastered, not only by professionals, but also by individual investors.
You know, and it's obvious a lot of people may actually be investing, but they don't actually know they're speculating because they're flying without charts, so to speak, without knowledge, and they wind up taking big risks and as a result lose a lot of money. I mean, that obviously happened in, what, 2008, 2009. But then they go to the flip side. You know, it's what I call the difference between the left ditch and a right ditch in the road is the fact that one ditch is on the left side and the other's on the right. You're supposed to stay out of both of them. You're supposed to be going down the road. So that's what they do. They panic and jump out of one ditch, run across the road, overreact, and go to the other side. That's equally bad.
Yeah, I mean, you think about it, it's a reflection, I think, John, more so than anything else today, the times that we live in. I mean, let's face it, we've seen vast changes to the economy and markets. Think of the companies that were in business 5 years ago, or think of what Amazon has done to retailing, what Netflix is doing to cable television, or what it's even doing to the major networks. And let's face it, you go back when I started my investment career, which was the end of 1979, 1980, for the next two decades, I mean, it was pretty calm markets. Yeah, we had a few crises in between, but let's face it, stocks went up for almost two decades. And we were living in a period of time. I mean, I remember I started out mainly doing bonds in the 80s because, you know, you could get 9.5% on tax-free bonds. I can remember my very first client putting her in a treasury note that was over 15% for 10 years. Imagine folks making 15% on a treasury note today. And that was pretty much it. And then in the 90s, when Greenspan took over the Fed and began slashing interest rates, money began to gravitate out of the bond market into the stock market. And we had this fabulous run in stocks from 1995 to, let's say, the beginning of 2000. So we had a two-decade run where stocks went up, interest rates were in the double digits or high single digits. Let's talk about how things have changed. In 2007, you could have got 5% on a two-year treasury note. Today, 2014, you can barely get 0.4% on a treasury note. So the markets have changed, John, along with the economy. And so knowing your attitude about money has never become more important because it's a more difficult market to navigate. Things are much different today in terms of your choices, the things that you could do. I mean, I can remember hiding out in zero coupon bonds during the recession of 1991, going into foreign sovereign bonds in 2000 and 2001. There's no way that I would want to buy German, Greek, or let's say Italian or Spanish bonds with yields below treasuries right now for 10 years, lock up my money for 2%? No way. So it's a much, much different environment, I think, that people have to operate on. And I think that is driving a lot of this nervousness that we have seen with investors, and especially after going through two bear markets, not to mention the bear market in real estate.
It was interesting this afternoon, just before we get ready to do the show, a friend of mine asked, well, how do you make money right now? And he was thinking of gold or silver or something like that. And I said, well, stock market's doing really, really well. And he gets a strange look. He said, you've got to be kidding me. You know, so this does go back to that. I've seen it with friends and acquaintances, investors in the past in markets and real estate. They're now in cash. They're now in bond funds. Even worse, hunkering down in the bunker or relying on gold or metals to do it and very much afraid to come out. This is why there's that third stage of the bull market, Jim, that you talked about previously on the Financial Sense NewsHour. And that was all of a sudden at one point they do wake up and say, wow, something's going on over there. I guess we've got to do something. And they jump out and into the market. And that's usually the point where it turns over and goes down again. But they're afraid of every correction as it is. Every correction is a harbinger of that imminent crash that's going to be heading their direction, or say, for example, the dollar on the side. And in reality, the opposite has happened. The stock market's up 200%, hitting new record highs. And so if you wanted to make some money, this was the place to be.
Well, you know, this is the reason we talk so many times about diversification here on the program, because you need to know who you are as an investor. Not every investment is going to be a perfect investment for you, and you can't achieve everything you want with one investment. I think that's one of the big problems that we've seen with investors, John, probably following the financial crisis. They've been looking for that kind of like the pill. It's kind of like going to the doctor, and the doctor says, look, you're overweight, your cholesterol's high, you have a health risk. You need to do a couple things. You need to diet, you need to exercise, you need to get rid of stress. A lot of times people say, you know, I don't want to do that. Can you just give me a pill I can take? Well, I think investors have been looking for an investment pill. And you don't want to be caught up in all the daily noise of the market. Because let's face it, we have 24-hour news today. Something happens, it's either on Twitter, you know, there's a tweet that's sent out. News is instantaneous. And what you don't want to be doing is making life-changing decisions on your emotions, because, John, you and I know how the media can take an event, whether it's Ebola, it's ISIS, it's the physical cliff, the depth, whatever it is, and turn it into a fear or a national crisis and overdramatize it. And making decisions on an emotional basis are very dangerous to your health. And that's why you need to know what your money mine is. It's easier to come up with a plan and invest with a greater chance for success when you know who you are as an investor. You can't be a growth and aggressive investor in the tech boom between 98 and 2000, then all of a sudden you're a conservative capital preservation investor after the crash and financial crisis of 2008 and 2009. You can't be altering who you are because it's disastrous. I mean, look at the example. A vast majority, we know this from stats, the vast majority of the public's money has gone into bond funds after the crash. A lot of people just said, you know what, that's it. Two bear markets in stocks, I'm out of here. I'm in bond funds. But if you take a look at, had you invested in something like spiders, even with this recent correction, since the bull market began, reinvesting dividends, you would have been up 194% with dividends reinvested, 162% without dividends. Now, you compare that to the Treasury Fund of TLT, which is up, let's say, 36.5% with dividends reinvested, but only 13% without dividends reinvested, not to mention how dividends have come down. And the same thing with the popular ETF of corporate bonds, which has done better. It's up 62% with dividends reinvested, only up about 27.5% had you spent the money. So a big difference, John, between 194%, 36%, or 62%. Think of your saving and retirement over the last 5 or 6 years, the difference those numbers could have made towards your retirement.
So what do you do when the husband and wife have different attitudes on risk-taking towards money? I mean, Carol and I all the time debate stuff here. You know, we're pretty active in everything we're doing. And sometimes it gets into a little tugging back and forth. Other times we see eye to eye on stuff. I mean, it would seem that that would make it more difficult, especially if you can't get to some kind of consensus. And that's even more especially if one spouse really wants to do it. Or if, say, for example, one spouse makes the financial decisions and the other runs the business, whatever that might happen to be.
Well, I mean, that's why I think it's very important when you start getting into talking about investments or setting up a retirement plan. I mean, what we try to do is engage both spouses in the process, because what you're trying to do is really bridge the gap between the two, because both husband and wife could have completely different attitudes towards money. You could also have, as we'll discuss in one of our case studies today, a big age gap between the two. So obviously, if let's say the wife is age 60 and husband is age 70, or let's say husband's age 60, wife's age 50, they may have two completely different attitudes on money. Or when there has been, let's say, some bad experiences, maybe they've lost a lot of money. They've been in, let's say, a bad market. They lost a lot of money. They got out at the wrong time. They got into precious metals, whatever it is, being traumatized by going through some, really, what we have seen is probably been some of the more difficult markets. When you think about the 80s and 90s, things were pretty much on cruise control, whether you were in bonds, CDs, or the stock market. You compare that to the last decade. 2 years of a bear market between 2000 and 2002. Then we had a 5-year up move. Then we hit another peak and another financial crisis. This time you got hammered in bonds. You got hammered in stocks. You got hammered in real estate. You know, bad experience like that, John, is going to impact how your attitude is towards markets and how you look at money.
Yeah, use an expression here, bad experiences. What does that mean?
Let's just take the most recent financial crisis, as so many people have done, and it's shown this in outflows of equity funds. They panicked at the bottom of the bear market in 2009, and they went to cash. A lot of those people are still there. Or, even worse, they put too much money in the gold market. Think what has happened to gold investors the last 3 or 4 years as they've listened to all the imminent predictions of gloom and doom and have been waiting around for the next crash, which never happened. A lot of portfolios, John, we've seen have gotten very decimated by not only selling stocks at the bottom, even worse, going to cash or going into gold. And I mean, have you been in gold and you bought in 2010-11? Think what has happened to that right now. And, you know, we've often discussed this in the past, but they both demonstrate some of the issues that we're really discussing here. You really need to know who you are as an investor. You need to know if you're the speculating type or you're an investor, and you don't change. You don't go to being conservative versus aggressive, and you can't be going back and forth, because you're going to be making emotional decisions, following the herd, and getting in or getting out at the wrong time.
How do you resolve these issues? Say, for example, you have a husband and wife, they have different philosophies, and they say, okay, I'm going to take my puddle over here and I'm going to invest it. Or the wife says, I'm going to take my puddle and do it over here. Or do you just bump into a situation where you really have irreconcilable differences on this?
I mean, it gets a little tougher if the attitudes are wide apart. You know, let's say the husband is the gambler and the wife is the more cautious, or vice versa. That makes it much more difficult. And you usually try to reach some kind of a compromise. I mean, recently we did a plan where basically the husband made the money, managed the money, and what he wanted to do is have a retirement plan. He was getting closer to his 70s and said, look, I'm 8 years older than my wife, and I want to have a plan. So he tried to bring her into the plan. John, she wasn't interested. They were members of a country club. They lived a good life. She had a lot of friends. She had a lot of confidence in her husband and say, look, you've always made the financial decisions. You made the money. I trust you to find a solution. She didn't want to be part of the plan. I mean, when we presented the final plan, he insisted that she be there, but basically she had no input. It was, hey, I trust you, my husband. You've made the money. You go ahead and make the decision. So in this case, what we did is we have a trustee that's going to come into play with the trust. If he passes on, we'll be managing the money with a trustee that is going to oversee to protect his wife. She has no interest in it. In another case, this was a situation where the husband made the money. He made the financial decisions. Wife, I mean, she didn't even manage the checkbook. And unfortunately, he had a serious illness that lasted for a little over 6 months before he passed away. And all of a sudden, John, the last couple months of the illness, he was too sick to write the checks, to focus on investment decisions. All the things that were going on in his mind at that time was making sure his estate plan was in order. And when he passed on, what we were able to do is we got his accountant. His accountant basically pays the bills. She has a debit card. She has a credit card. She's going on living life because her husband provided for her. That was in the plan. So she's going to live comfortable the rest of her life. But we have an accountant, and if he retires or phases out of the picture, that's when the backup trustee will come in, take care of the bills. Obviously, they're going to be charging a fee for that, but there's enough money in the estate to do that. But that was the situation in both cases. In one case, we have a trustee that will come in when the husband passes away. In the second case, his accountant is taking care of the bills for the wife. And if he decides to retire, no longer wants to take on those responsibilities, we have a backup trustee. So here was a situation where we had to resolve it with a third party because one spouse simply wasn't interested.
But at least here you had a plan put in place, either a trustee for the wife in one case and the other an accountant, backup trustee, you know, any of these things tends to work. But it is a process. I mean, you've got something established that everybody recognizes the rules and abides by the rules. You really need to have a real attitude towards money. And this attitude then becomes the real driver behind everything that goes into the plan. Because if they aren't on the page of what you would call the worldview assumption of how it's going to be used, then that becomes a divider. Now, if you can get them to reconcile on some kind of a plan that they both have, that might work. I know when Carol and I started out, we met working for a television network, and the first project we worked on together before we were even engaged, we began arguing and fighting over stuff, etc. And we realized that if this was going to survive at any time in the future.
I still hear you guys arguing and fighting. So, I mean, you know, nothing's changed, John.
Carol, I told you to close the mic.
You did not.
Anyway, and so what we did is we developed an area of what we called overlapping circles. And so when we worked together on a project, I had my area, she had her area, and we overlapped at certain points and exchanged data and info and recommendations. But generally, we stayed out of each other's areas, sort of. I think we've lapsed on that sometimes.
Have you found that to be the case in managing money, or is it a joint decision? I mean, do you make it jointly together and discuss it, and then maybe she defers to you or you defer to her? I mean, how did you guys reconcile the differences?
We usually do it jointly. We talk about everything that's happening and then what the priorities are going to be. And then if you feel strongly about it, somebody will say, well, we've just got to do this now. I can't wait to this. Just trust me or whatever. And then, all right, you run with this. You know, you take care and you do what you need to do over here. That's the way we do it. But the overlapping circles does work. You know, it's worked very successful, both in not just money management, but in doing radio and TV productions, which is what we're still doing today. You know, I suspect a little hand holding, you know, it's a little love, a little kindness, usually a lot of beatings.
Well, okay. She disagrees with you. Beat her. No,
no, she beats me. That's the
problem. Oh, she beats you. Okay. Yeah. Well, no, I mean, you know, at first it seems trivial, but a lot of time on the front end of a plan is spent. It's sort of an education process, and it's really getting people to evaluate and think on a deeper level of their attitude towards money. I mean, it may seem inconsequential, but you're thinking of, well, wait a minute. You're trying to put a plan together. And once you put a plan, John, you know, it's just like a roadmap. It's GPS. You're at point A. You want to get to point B. You got to follow that plan. You can't say, well, you know what? We were going to travel down I-5. Let's go down I-15 and see where that leads us. You can't do that. So it's a lot of time spent in the education process, talking about risk, talking about outcomes, talking about income, and different ways to solve a solution. And one of the things invariably I always do, and especially when you have fears of the market, is always go over what happened in 2008. Because I know if I don't bring it up, it will be brought up if you mention the word stocks. Hey, I think you ought to have some dividend stocks for inflation, for income, for increasing income over time to take care of those later years. Well, the first thing that's going to come, if you've been traumatized by a market downturn, that is going to come into the equation at some point in time. So we try to talk about what happened in 2008. What would it look like had we put the investment plan in place January 1, 2008? How would it look like in March of 2009? And you have to go over that because that's the first thing on the minds of risk-averse investors. And that's why I usually try to bring it up, because I know that thought is out there. I mean, you couldn't have come through the financial crisis or seen what's happened to your income with zero interest rates, and this isn't in the back of your mind. And if not between two, you know, you think about how many people have been traumatized by what we've seen. It's reflected in what's happened in fund outflows. It's reflected in where money has been invested over the last 6 years. The Wall Street Journal, Barron's, Huffington Post, a lot of our financial media has talked about how people's minds towards markets and money have changed dramatically over the last 5 or 6 years. You know, we also try to explain our risk control measures. But John, this is a process. I mean, you know, it begins with, how do you think or feel about money? And it's not just the husband, it's both spouses. What are the things that matter most to me? Where are you today financially? How do I get to where I need to go? And given my circumstances and what am I doing right now, am I on course? And it's really understanding your money mind or your attitude towards money, because out of this process, you're going to identify and understand your dominant money mind. In other words, what is your attitude? What kind of investor? You're going to recognize in the process situations in the past where your money mind drove a particular financial decision. Maybe you got out of the market in March, or you jumped on board gold in 2011. And what you hope to do by coming through this is identify better options with ones you care about that will help you achieve with greater probability where you want to be in retirement versus being subject to the whims of the market as so many people are today.
So if we summarize all of this for this part of the program, you basically have to know who you are and have a realistic attitude toward the money. And there needs to be a compromise between the two spouses. They have to come together at the table of reality. This is a process in many cases. I've seen places, I worked for a gentleman one time who used to make a lot of money, and his wife would sort of run every month with this huge a clothing and spending budget. And then when he finally says, we've got to rein this in, that did not go down well. You know, he was just looking at the, what we call the gazintas and the gazoutas, you know, the income and the outgo. And said, we can't do this anymore. So you, this mindset has to be the same. Otherwise, you can have a lot of tension too in the family over this whole thing. What we need to do now is turn to new case studies, which we always do every week here on the program when we can. Situations because of the previous bear markets, which we've seen, emotional decisions being made that ultimately turned out to be detrimental or caught up in the emotions of whatever they were hearing on the news, frozen into inabilities to act or to think. And thinking clearly in those cases is really important. This week's case study deals with several of the issues we've discussed on the program. What am I afraid of? And having no plan. What am I afraid of? Issues would probably include higher inflation, outliving your assets, cuts or changes to Social Security, lower than expected returns, healthcare costs, and incapacity in later life.
Yeah, these are probably some of the more common issues that you're going to deal with. Either you're in retirement, you're a few years away from it, or you've been in retirement for a while and you're running into these issues. We're going to call this the case of Tom and Sue Fear. Tom retired in 2002. Basically, at that time, he put half of his assets, as so many people did, about half in bond funds. At that time, they were paying 6% and half in stock funds. So 50-50 allocation in terms of diversification. You know, it's better than putting it all in stocks. Let's put it that way. So it was a very typical plan in terms of what you see in a lot of these pie charts. He had Social Security and he had a sizable IRA rollover and some personal savings. Now, that was sort of a plan. It wasn't a formalized plan. It was just like, hey, I'm retired. I have a greater need for income, so I'm going to put more money into bond funds. And back then, you could get 6% on bonds. And so it was a great plan, and it worked until it didn't. And unfortunately, along comes a financial crisis in 2008 and 2009, and he sold his stock funds, not initially with the first part of the crisis, but because right after 2009, you know, the market started to come back, especially in the spring of 2009. But what did it was the May 2010 flash crash, because, John, you remember when that event happened, you know, within a couple of minutes, the Dow was down 1,000 points. That's where he panicked. And what used to be a seven-figure IRA was reduced by $1.2 million when he retired to $720,000 at the bottom of the market in 2009, got its way back up to almost 950, almost all the way back. But then the flash crashed in 2009, and what happened was even worse. Got out of the market, found another financial advisor, and basically was put into assets that would benefit for a dollar collapse in hyperinflation. Unfortunately, that was the wrong asset allocation because it was specifically geared towards one type of event happening. And that's not the way markets work. But what was personal assets were $600,000 in bond funds, $200,000 in CDs at the bank.
Outside of what they saw in the market, what were their greatest concerns?
Well, I think at this point, especially after losing a substantial amount of money, number one, seeing the money that they had invested in bond funds drop every year as interest rates were brought down, it was like, hey, do I have enough assets now? Or do I run the risk of outliving my assets? And then the other thing, especially after the financial crisis, was lower than expected returns. Then obviously inflation. You know, the government figures are 2%. When you look at what most people are spending, the basic expenses, utilities and food, it's probably gone up a little bit more than that.
Well, now, what about healthcare and medical? Because that tends to be a ballooning issue as we age.
You know, the fortunate thing for them, in their 50s, they bought a long-term care policy when they retired, so that wasn't an issue. The main problem were investment fears, number one, in outliving their assets in fear of market advisors. And they almost got into that bunker mentality of looking for the next crisis. In 2010, after losing money and then seeing that money come back, they said, okay, we'll go to a financial advisor, a well-known advisor, put them all in foreign stocks over fears of a dollar crash and a market collapse. I hate to say it, but in the market collapse of 2008, foreign stocks actually did worse than U.S. stocks. So unfortunately, they lost another $150,000. The dollar went up, not down. In foreign stocks actually lost money, and the U.S. became the best looking house in a bad neighborhood. So even worse, they were also getting hit on the bond fund side because they kept reducing the dividends on a monthly basis as the Fed kept driving bond yields. Remember, folks, 2007, we were probably at a little over 5% on treasuries. Now, take a look at where we're at now. We're at 0.1% on a one-year treasury bill and less than 0.5% on a two-year treasury note. So, you know, they've seen their income go down. They lost assets on what should have been a secure retirement. And Tom was expecting the worst. And you can't blame him, seeing a loss in income, seeing a loss in the financial crisis, going to another advisor and losing even more money.
Okay, so obviously things were swirling out of control here. How did you get them back on track?
Basically, the first thing you have to do is, if you're worried about outliving your assets, how much are you spending? So we had to take a look at what their budget was, what it was costing, the basic living expenses, and then we also had to look at assets. And then we knew what the shortfall was. Once we were describing that, the shortfall was almost $1,000 a month. So even though they had a high concentration in cash, I said, you know, one way or another, you can lose it in the market or you're going to eat it away in principal. If you're living off your principal to the tune of $1,000 a month, that's $12,000 a year you're eating into principal. So the thing was, their income strategy, cash, wasn't going to cut it. And they couldn't remain there, as many of you listening to this program know very well. You can't live on a one-year treasury bill. You can't live at what the bank's paying you. So one half of the battle plan really took them through the dividend drill. This was probably the toughest thing I had to overcome, because I had to show them that, hey, despite the crisis in 2008, Coca-Cola still paid you a dividend. And guess what? At the end of the year, they raised the dividend 8%. They did the same thing in 2009. Johnson & Johnson, Exxon. So I had to take them through that to show them that, yes, the stock price went down. But if you didn't look at the stock price and you didn't dump it, the stock price came back. And during the whole crisis, you were not only getting your dividends, but the companies were actually giving you pay hikes. And so I got them to focus on the dividend increases and told them, you know, income wasn't going to change. Coca-Cola didn't change its dividend. Exxon didn't change its dividend, unlike, let's say, what they were experiencing with their stock mutual funds, or worse, their bond funds. And most importantly, you know, I talked about, you know, you're worried about outliving your assets. You're worried about inflation. Well, how are you going to handle that if you have nothing in your portfolio that will go up or increase the income over time? So the next issue we had to address was the bond funds and CDs. The bond funds had basically gone from the time he was retired at 6% to the current less than 3%. The income had gone from $45,000 to $18,000. And, you know, the CDs had gone, at the time we did this plan, as they matured, from 5% CDs to 0.5%. So there was a loss of income of $26,000. So what we had to do, and they were comfortable, we moved the bond funds to laddered bonds. At the time we did this plan, which was a couple of years ago, it was 4.5%. We moved the CDs, which was too much money in cash, over to bond portfolio. So the income went from $19,000 to $36,000. And plus, the deficit was reduced, and we ended up with a surplus of $6,000. And it made not only a difference, because they were not only not having to dip into their principal, they had predictable income from their laddered bond portfolio, and we had a plan. So the income was not going to be affected by a market correction, by the stocks we own. We covered their inflation fears and the dollar, since the companies we own were all blue chip multinational companies. I said, you know, if you're Coca-Cola and you're getting 70% of your sales overseas and the dollar goes down, that means the sales that you make overseas actually go up. So that was really the big issue.
It would seem like what happened here was that first, well, they put some of their money in a bond bucket, so to speak, and some in a stock bucket. But then as a result of what happened in the crash, they put all their assets in one bucket, then into foreign stocks and into precious metals. And they were making these, if you notice, these are what I call erratic, lurching decisions back and forth, decisions being made on a crisis basis, operating out of irrational fear with no reason. And right at that point, they are really susceptible to falling prey to somebody trying to sell them something, and that seems to be what they did.
Well, that's exactly what we did, and that's why almost half of our time was getting through these emotional fears, and especially it just wasn't the loss in the bond market. It was also the loss of income that began from the day he retired in 2002, but also the loss of stocks and what happened to their assets. So the laddered bonds dealt with the loss of income. Stocks dealt with, let's say, inflation fears. Instead of falling income, they were back to rising income because that's what happens when you own dividend-paying blue chips. And the names in the portfolio, I mean, you know, folks, how many people lose sleep over somebody like an Exxon? I mean, Exxon has a better credit rating than the U.S. government. But, John, you had to deal with those fears until we did. It didn't make a difference until I actually showed them. Coca-Cola's dividends, we went through like five or six of the stocks that we were owning at the time, showed them their dividends through the financial crisis, and that was probably the big surprise. Oh, the dividend didn't go down? No, it went up. They didn't stop paying a dividend. And so that was an issue to go through, and then also explaining to them how a laddered bond portfolio locks in the return and the income, and it doesn't change, assuming you're buying high-quality credits. So that was what made the difference of having a plan and also dealing with their emotional fears.
That was the case of Tom and Sue Fear. Gee, however did you pick that name? Anyway, I imagine you've gotten quite a number of those over the last few years, and I would bet they're pretty much similar.
Sure. I mean, think of what we went through. We've never seen 0% interest rates here in the United States. We never saw a crisis to the tune of, think of, John, the early days of 2008, the bailout of AIG, merging of Merrill Lynch, and so many of the companies that were going under, you know, trillion-dollar deficits, bailouts of these big Wall Street titan firms were, you know, basically, we were in pretty serious difficulties back then. So, I mean, you can understand where a lot of people are thinking. And so a lot of people, having gone through the bursting of the tech bubble when we were supposed to have overcome the business cycle to revisit a bear market 5 years later, and this one even worse than the previous one, and then throw in a bear market in real estate. So the next case, we talked about this case a couple of years ago, but this will exemplify a couple different things, because in this case, we have the fear of money and the markets, but we also had a different attitude about finances. And this was quite honestly a reflection of 8 years difference in age between the two. And this is the case of Bill and Jan Smith. Bill was age 66, retired. Jan was 58. She was going to retire in 2 years. She was working as a teacher with an $80,000 salary. In terms of their income, Bill's Social Security was roughly about $1,450 a month, $17,400. When Jan retired, with a number of years of service, she would get 66% of her salary as a teacher of $80,000. That would be $54,120. So their income would be $71,500 against a budget of $105,000. So right off the bat, there was a problem. We had a shortage of roughly about $33,000 a year. Now, you hear that number, you think, how in the heck are you going to overcome that? Let's talk about what we did. Now, when we took a look at their budget, basically, we got them to sort of, let's get this down to basics. What does it really cost you to live? $90,000 was their essential budget. I know a lot of you probably listening to this program in the Midwest probably think that's a lot of money. Southern California and California or the East Coast, that is not a lot of money, especially when you take a look at property taxes, sales tax, gas tax, food cost, housing cost here. Folks, that's not a lot of money to live. Must-haves, which were quality of life, was about $10,000, and want-to-haves was $5,000. That was basically putting money into a education account for their grandchildren. So the total was roughly about $105,000, about $71,500 coming in from pensions. So a shortfall of $33,000. Now, if we take a look at what they had a home, $450,000. Bill had an IRA of $650,000. Got to remember, at one time, this was an $800,000 IRA prior to the crash. Jan had $300,000 in a annuity, which was her 403b plan as a teacher, and they had roughly about $40,000 in savings. So total investment assets, just shy of $1 million at the time they came in to see us, about $990,000. Total assets were $1,440,000. liabilities against that home, $300,000, so a net worth about $1.1 million. And it gets back to John, I always used to say a joke, what is a California millionaire? It's a homeowner.
Well, like everybody, they had issues. In this case, the wife was younger, so there was an offset there. And then she retired, which meant no salary, and they didn't have as much income coming in from the pension. They were very fearful of the markets, which is very common. Anything else that I missed?
Yeah, one other issue, in addition to the 8 years difference between both Bill and Sue, or Bill and Jen, that is, one of the big issues here is Bill had cardiovascular disease, had a heart attack, bypass surgery, taken meds, pretty good. I mean, diet change, exercise, but he did have cardiovascular disease. And plus, on top of that, there was an 8 year difference between the two of them. So in addition to market fears, it was also outliving assets. From Jan's perspective, it was like, okay, Bill's got a heart condition. I'm 8 years younger. Ann and Jan's family, they lived into their late 80s. And in fact, she had a grandmother that lived into her 90s. So we had longevity issues, especially on Jan's side. So we talked about the budget. We had the shortfall. What we had to do here is when somebody is traumatized, as many people were coming through the financial crisis, is you're not going to take that person and go back into the stock market and say, hey, if we just stay in the market the next 4 or 5 years, we'll try to make back the money you lost. So one of the things that we did is we took a good portion of Bill's IRA and we put it in a laddered bond portfolio, roughly about 4% at the time, and then $150,000 in dividend paying stocks at 3%. Because I said, look, you can't put it all in bonds because what if interest rates go down? You know, you're talking about outliving your inflation fears. And here was what we talked about, a money difference. Jan was more concerned about inflation down the road versus Bill. Obviously, that's reflecting longevity in her family and also the issue of 8 years being younger than her husband. So what we did is we took a good bulk of Bill's IRA, put it into a laddered bond portfolio at 4%. That was producing $20,000 income, $150,000 in stocks at 3%, roughly about $4,500 a year. Now, what we did is we did something that created some certainty here. Remember, basically, Jan had a salary of $80,000, dropped down to $54,000 roughly when she retired. So what we did is we took her $230,000 annuity and put it in, this was her 403b plan, and we put it into a 10-year certain immediate annuity. And the reason we did that is longevity on her part and age difference, and that created $24,000 a year. So if she predeceased Bill, let's say she got in a car accident or something, the payments would continue for at least 10 years, so Bill would be assured of that. But more importantly, we just created an additional pension for Jan and brought the income up. Then what we did is we took about $70,000 and put it into some dividend-paying stocks. So the total investment income was now a little over $50,000, and that created an income stream of $122,000 and less a budget of $105,000. The other thing that we also did here, which was very important to Jan, they had a home in a community very close to the golf course and the club that they belonged to. We refinanced the home on a 15-year mortgage. So at her age, she knew at age 73, basically the home would be free and clear and paid for. So we already had long-term care insurance paid for. To cover inflation and health care, we had dividend growth investments from part of Bill's IRA and part of Jan's 403b, which was rolled over into an IRA. And then what we did is to sort of get rid of future expenses down the road, refinance the mortgage. This was back in the days before Taper Talk when you could get a 3% mortgage on a 15-year mortgage at 3%, a laddered bond portfolio, and to make up for the loss of her salaried income by retiring and going to a pension, we made up the difference by using a good portion of her 403b plan, putting that into an annuity that would last Jan throughout her entire lifetime.
So what you did here is you solve the inflation and the healthcare issue using stocks, dividend paying stocks, and Jan's security issue because of the offset and that she could live a lot longer than her husband, refinancing the house on a 15-year basis and then creating an annuity. And to overcome Bill's fears as far as market uncertainty, you put a lot of his IRA in a laddered bond portfolio, and that seemed to address that issue.
Exactly. And like I said, there's just no way you're going to take somebody that experienced losses like they did in the market downturn and say, hey, we're going to go 60-70% in stocks. And, you know, I don't care how many times I told Bill about we're in a bull market. Now, remember, folks, this was done back in this plan, I believe it was towards the end of 2010, 2011, where we still had a lot of fears in the market. And it was a situation, there's just no way that you're going to take somebody with those kind of fears and say, let's go 60-70% in stocks and expect that person to sleep at night. So it was one of those money issues that had to be discussed between both sides, because there were some differences about longevity and inflation in this case that had to be resolved.
Coming up next, Jim will interview Dr. Greg Sperber, the subject being acupuncture and pain relief, combination of Eastern and Western medicine. All of that coming up next right here at FinancialSense.com.
Well, as you head into retirement, probably next to your money, the most important thing is your health. And what we've seen in the healthcare industry, whether it's the Affordable Care Act, is our attitude toward health is changing. And that includes medicine. We know a lot more about diet today and exercise. We also know about different forms of medicine. Joining us on the program is Dr. Greg Sperber. He is the Dean of College of Eastern Medicine at the Southern California University of Health Sciences. He's also the author of several books. And Doctor, you practice acupuncture. Let's talk about when that's used and how is that being woven into traditional medicine. In other words, if I'm going in for a physical, I have an ailment, fibromyalgia, or something that's going on with me, when does an acupuncturist come in versus, let's say, a traditional doctor examines you and you take a pill?
I think that's a great question. And I would say it's really dependent on the doctor that the patient is seeing. I think doctors are more and more open to acupuncture and oriental medicine. And what we've seen lately, there's been a lot of evidence that's very good for pain and pain management. And so more and more doctors do refer for pain management. But it does so much more than that. You mentioned fibromyalgia, and there's a lot of studies coming out about autoimmune diseases and how acupuncture and oriental medicine can help in those cases. And so more and more doctors are open to that. I do have a medical degree, so I am a Western medical doctor as well as a doctor of acupuncture and oriental medicine. So I kind of see both sides of this. More and more people are seeing more and more reasons to go and see acupuncture. Even though traditional medical doctors see it mostly as pain management, it can be effective in a lot of other lifestyle diseases. And I think lifestyle diseases is a real strong point. Those areas where traditional medicine do pills that kind of help, but they don't do anything fundamentally to change the situation. Those are things. So, for example, insomnia could fall into that situation. There are lots of acupuncture, oriental medicine. When I say oriental medicine, I'm talking about acupuncture is one of a couple dozen modalities that we may use, and probably the second biggest one is Chinese herbs or herb formulas. That's a huge one, but we do exercises and things along those lines as well. We do a lot for something like insomnia, and we're very well known for chemotherapy-induced nausea. So if someone is getting treated for chemotherapy and are having nausea, there's a lot of evidence that we can be very useful in that situation.
A number of years ago, I was doing advanced Pilates. I injured myself. The result was sciatica. And I went to traditional medicine. They wanted to do various things. And then I ran into a chiropractor. He made some adjustments. And then I also got a special stretching machine. And through the process of stretching, I don't have any problems with it anymore. And I solved this versus, let's say, going in for a possible operation and just messing with my back in a ways that maybe the outcome would not have been as successful.
Absolutely. And I think when we're looking at low back pain and neck pain, you're exactly right. I think absolutely traditional medicine has its roles in there, but at least initially more conservative interventions should happen. And I often recommend chiropractic in situations like that, as well as acupuncture, because I think we do a lot as the combination of things. And for me, one of the big red flags is when, I don't want to give medical advice, but often when someone has said, let's do a cortisone shot for this scenario, my clinical experience, and it's only mine, I don't want to broaden out, I haven't looked at the evidence around that, is about 50% of the time that's very helpful, and about 50% of the time it doesn't help or it makes it worse. And so why not try something like acupuncture or chiropractic before that cortisone shot? And then if that doesn't work, maybe cortisone shot is the next approach. So I look at this as sort of a more conservative approach to a lot of things. And of course, when someone's in pain, they don't want the conservative approach. They want the pain relief in 5 minutes. And so it's difficult sometimes when we're looking at risks versus benefits. How do you judge those things when you're in pain?
Yeah, because a lot of times people want a pill, and sometimes you can become over-reliant on pills, and sometimes to the detriment of your health longer term. And I would suspect that the traditional forms of medicine, you talked about autoimmune diseases, pain, chemo, these are things that are more prevalent today in terms of treatments that are being given to either cancer patients or people that have back pains. Let's talk about autoimmune disease, because we're seeing a lot more of that.
Absolutely. And in my experience, you know, there are some great rheumatologists that can help those situations. But I think for the most part, Western medicine does palliation in those cases. They try to minimize the body's reactions to them and the pain and the symptoms, but they don't always know how to treat the underlying syndrome. And I'm not sure Chinese medicine has that either, but I certainly know anecdotally of many, many cases that autoimmune diseases have been treated very successfully through acupuncture and oriental medicine. I want to add that oriental medicine component to this, because especially with something that's autoimmune, I really feel like herbology is, acupuncture is great and is definitely important, but the herbology is also a necessary component to successful treatment.
A number of years ago, we have things like acupuncture now. We have chiropractic medicine that's being applied. I mean, that helped me initially with my back pain, but I was looking for something that went beyond that because it really affected something I like to do, which was sailing. I'd get these sciatic attacks, and especially when you're healing in a boat, which was putting pressure on my lower spine. Is it becoming, doctor, more acceptable? Because when I went to the traditional medicine route, seeing an orthopedic doctor, and that wasn't helping or getting me to where I wanted to be. When I mentioned the chiropractor, it was kind of frowned upon. Is that necessarily the case today with, I know chiropractic medicine is being more recognized, insurance companies pay for it, especially if you're in an auto injury. Is the same thing happening with acupuncture today?
I would say it's happening much more extensively and rapidly than it is with chiropractic. Acupuncture really has turned around in the last 15 to 20 years. When I was a student going through acupuncture school in the early 90s, when I'd say I was an acupuncture student, I got one of two responses. One was, that is so cool. And then the other one was, that stuff doesn't really work, does it? And I'm like, yeah, I'm just wasting 4 years of my life for no reason, you know? Now, when I say I'm an acupuncturist, the response I get is one of two things. One is, do you accept insurance? That's one of the top questions I get. And the other one is, oh, yeah, my mother, my sister, my brother, my aunt, whatever it is, has done that. And before, no one had tried it. No one had done it. And now everybody knows somebody who's done it. And the response is much less confrontational than it was just 15 or 20 years ago. So just anecdotally, I think that's a huge issue. And I know in my practice, I see a lot more people saying, my doctor said to go get some acupuncture. And so that's a huge one. And I would add that doctors are doing that for acupuncture. There's still a lot of fear among doctors, consumers, and regulators about drug-herb interactions. So the herb side of it is maybe a little bit less than it was in the past. I think there was probably some more openness in the past than there is today. But acupuncture, absolutely a lot more acceptance.
Let me ask a question, and this gets to what you just said. One of the questions you're being asked today is, do you accept insurance? Does insurance pay for this?
Well, it really depends. Since insurance is regional, it depends where you're at. In the state of California, the estimates are approximately 50% of insurance policies have some sort of acupuncture benefits. Now, those may be discounts for people who are in the plan. There are certainly HMOs like Kaiser in certain localities that employ acupuncturists. Scripps Institute in San Diego has a Scripps Integrative Health Clinic, and UCSD has an integrative medical clinic. So I do think there's a lot more mainstreaming of it, and there is a lot more insurance that's being accepted.
You know, California kind of sets the trend, whether it's fashion, whether it's diet, you know, organic foods and things like that, you know, that started here. Is this something that's sort of like a California thing at this point, and then eventually it makes its way across the country? Or is this being widely accepted across the country today?
I think when we're talking specifically about insurance, I like to call it bi-coastal. I think if you look at Oregon, Washington, and California, in fact, I want to say Oregon, it may be Washington, one of them actually mandates that every insurance program has acupuncture benefits in the entire state. So very good on the left coast. And then when you go to the right coast, we have places like Florida, New York, and several other states that also are pretty progressive with their insurance benefits. When we get into the middle of the country, it's much more sporadic and much less consistent. So I do think it's a bi-coastal thing. However, depending on the estimates you look at, there are 20 to 30,000 acupuncturists in the country. And in California, there's about between 12 and 15,000. So we actually have, if not a clear majority, we have half the acupuncturists in the nation here in California.
Yeah, that's how I was thinking that, you know, maybe it's bi-coastal, as you just mentioned. Now, you have joint medical degrees, one in acupuncture and traditional medicine. As a practitioner, how do you know, I mean, is it just a feel depending on what the person has? It could be pain, it could be chemo, it could be an autoimmune disease. How do you mix the two of them? Because, you know, some of our listeners right here may be suffering from the very things that you're talking about. They may be going through chemotherapy. They may have an autoimmune disease. Maybe they have lower back pains, as I used to have at one time. How do you know which one to use? Is it kind of like something you gain from experience to say that, hey, I know this modality works much better under this circumstance or this particular case, so I'm going to use acupuncture here versus, let's say, take a pill or do something else? I mean, how do you merge the two together and know when?
I think that's a great question. I should probably preface it by saying, even though I have the 2 degrees, I'm actually licensed as an acupuncturist, not licensed as a medical doctor. That had to do with my last 6 months of medical school. I developed a spinal tumor, and so I never went through the licensing procedure for my medical degree. But I still use that every day in making decisions with my patients. And so what really boils down to me, first of all, there's a real broad clear cut for me, which is if it's an acute condition, generally you need to go see a medical doctor. So for example, if you have an acute infection, yeah, maybe my herbs and my acupuncture can help you with it, but I'm not taking a chance. You go get some antibiotics and get it taken care of. I always like to say, if I'm in a car accident, I'm not asking my ambulance driver to drop me off at my acupuncturist's office. Go ahead, bring me to the emergency room, save my life. I'm good with it. So I think if it's an acute condition, it's clearly under Western medicine. In the same token, a lot of chronic conditions, Western medicine is not great at. And we've been talking about pain. Chronic pain is one that there's pills and there's rehabilitation and all that. And those can be very effective, especially in the short term. But as it becomes longer and longer term, you shouldn't be using those interventions, or at least not the prescription interventions. And so acupuncture can be very helpful in that scenario. So I tend to actually see what happens with a pretty clear cut between Western medicine and Chinese medicine, which way they should go. Now, the one thing I do love about having the combination and having the background that I have is I can very clearly see what are red flags in any situation. So I can ask questions and see if there's anything that is serious that needs to be addressed more thoroughly. So as an acupuncture licensee, I'm not allowed to diagnose cancer, but I can see all the signs and say, you need to go see your doctor right away. And some of those signs, depending on the cancer, could be quite subtle. So I feel very comfortable with that red flag issue. And I should say, even though I've seen a lot of it with my Western medical background, that acupuncturists who don't have that Western medical background do 1/3 of the acupuncture course. And it's a 4-year course. So it's a 4-year master's degree at this point. And so they've had extensive training. 1/3 of that is in Western medicine. So every acupuncturist should be able to see those red flags. I think the difference between what my background is and the average acupuncturist is I've seen those situations in the emergency room and in the hospital wards. But they've all been trained in a lot of ways. But they've all been trained in that. And I think that's really important for listeners to know, is that you cannot get licensed in the state of California without that Western medical training.
If you were to take a look at acupuncture, where it is used most effectively, describe that.
Pain is a good one, especially chronic pain. We're very effective. And I think the research shows that we're very effective in something along those lines. I think in chronic conditions in general, we're really good at some gynecological issues, very good at helping with menopausal and perimenopausal symptoms, and we're very good at PMS and things along those lines as well. So gynecology, we're really good at. And of course, there's a lot of evidence that we're really great with assisting fertility. There's been a lot of research on that, and it's been quite consistently positive. So there's a lot of evidence in those scenarios. You know, traditionally, this medicine was the only medicine in China for thousands of years. So technically, it treats everything. There's nothing it doesn't treat. But that is not to say that it treats some things better than other things. And even though I keep making this distinction between acute and chronic, traditionally, it's an acute medicine as well. Like most medicines, some of the biggest jumps in effectiveness have happened from battlefield situations where you learn a lot from a lot of people being wounded. And it's happened in Western medicine as well. The American Civil War, and especially World War I, are key to the development of Western medicine. And certainly similar things have happened in Chinese medicine over the millennia. So it is an acute medicine, but in the States, malpractice and all that probably prevents us from doing a lot of that without huge medical legal risk. So it's all encompassing. You can treat everything, but not everything as effectively. And Western medicine, certainly, I don't want to disparage Western medicine. I think they're complementary. I think what Western medicine treats well, Chinese medicine doesn't treat as well. And what Chinese medicine treats well, Western medicine doesn't treat as well. So the short answer to your question is, we're really good at the things Western medicine is not good at.
Do you ever think, doctor, and I've had some of my own doctors who have listened to this program have described me, they go, you know, when we went to medical school, we learned very little about nutrition. And I've had some of my doctors say, I didn't know that about some of the diet things. And in traditional medicine, there isn't a lot of emphasis, at least I've been told, you can correct me if I'm wrong in this, that when you go to medical school, there isn't a lot of time spent on diet and the role that diet plays in health.
I think that's probably true. I don't think that may be as damning as it sounds on the surface, however. And the reason why I say that is there's a lot of things that aren't covered in medical school. And at least when I went to medical school, problem-based learning, I think 98% of medical colleges were using an educational approach called problem-based learning. And the idea was, if we instill self-learning and we support our students in trying to figure out what they need to know, then when other things come down the pike, they'll be able to assimilate that knowledge much more effectively and completely than if we just tried to throw everything but the kitchen sink for them to memorize. So I go back to my medical school training. Sure, we had a little segment on nutrition. It wasn't very big and it wasn't very long, but we were trained to find out any of the information we actually wanted to have. So I think nutrition plays such a large role in health. And I think in medical thought, I think that has increased over the decades that most doctors, even though they may not have been well trained in nutrition in medical school, have picked up a lot just in treating their day-to-day patients.
Do you think, or do you see the day, doctor, where as we're finding out more about diet, we're finding out about, you know, the role of chiropractic medicine, acupuncture, that in the future, let's say a person that's going through Western medicine or Western medical school will be exposed to more of these different disciplines or modalities, not just Western medicine, but say, hey, you know, you're going to have to take a couple courses and understand where acupuncture can come in here with treating chemo, pain, autoimmune, and the things that Eastern medicine does well compared to Western. And in other words, somebody coming out of medical school has a blend of knowledge rather than just one view of how to treat a patient.
Absolutely, yes. And what's even better is I don't have to rely on my own opinion for that. I can actually go to the Institute of Medicine. And the Institute of Medicine, if you're not familiar with it, is a think tank, and it's probably the most recognized nonpartisan think tank on medicine in the United States. And it's medicine. It's not necessarily anything else. And what they said a few years ago, they had a whole conference on integrative medicine. And what their conclusion was that within 20 years, integrative medicine will be completely mainstream. And they cited a whole bunch of reasons why that would be the case. But to boil it down to some of the more visceral reasons is as Western medicine becomes more technical and more investigation oriented. So, oh, you're having pain, let's send you to an MRI. It becomes more impersonal. And the average length of a general practice practitioner interview with a patient is, depending on the study that you look at, anywhere from 6 to 8 minutes. And so how can a doctor understand a condition, understand a patient in 6 to 8 minutes, even multiple 6 to 8 minutes? And so as Western medicine becomes more impersonal, the Institute of Medicine said, hey, there's going to be things like massage and chiropractic and Reiki and acupuncture coming in to add a little bit more of that personal touch to what's happening. And they actually said that the majority of medicine in this country, probably by 2030, is going to be this integrative style. So I think there's a huge movement on this, and I think that is driving the mainstreaming of a lot of these, what was known as complementary and alternative medicine and is now known as integrative medicine. And I think young doctors are really hungry for doing this and being part of it and supporting it, because they feel as doctors that something is a little bit missing from the interactions with patients. I'm sure there's plenty of doctors who are very comfortable with maybe not having that as much interpersonal, but most doctors love that interpersonal. That's why they got into medicine. And it's not as fulfilling for them either. And there's lots of information out there showing that as well.
Now, you're dean of the College of Eastern Medicine at Southern Cal University. Are you seeing, as you're just talking about, more and more doctors that are either coming and doing as you did? You got two medical degrees, one in Western, one in Eastern, that are pursuing the dual sort of degrees, just as we're seeing even in the business world. I know a lot of some of my friends that actually went to law school and got an MBA.
Yes. A lot of medical doctors who get MBAs and law degrees as well. I think as our lifespan increases, and we're up in the 80s now as an average lifespan, more importantly, not only are we living longer, but our quality of life is better as we're living longer. You know, I look at my mom, who's in her 70s now, and she just looks completely different than what I remember 70-year-olds looking like when I was younger. And maybe that's just youth versus me getting older. But my point is, the quality of life indicators are showing that we do have a better quality of life. So we're living longer and we're living better. And so what happens with our career of, you know, what used to be 30 years for a good career now can be 50 or 60 years for a good career. Does someone stay in the same career for that entire time? What do they do to seek out more challenges and more of that? And I think we're seeing a lot more of these multiple degrees and these multi careers, I'm going to say, you know, these people combining careers and interdisciplinary. And that's a huge movement, you know, in medicine, being a medical doctor and an engineer, now a medical engineer. And that's really important. So I think we're seeing a lot of that. At my school, we have several colleges, but another big college is Los Angeles Chiropractic College. And so we see a lot of dual degrees of chiropractic and acupuncture, master's of acupuncture and oriental medicine. And so we see a lot of those dual degrees happening here on campus. And I think that's a trend that's happening everywhere. I do think there's more MDs doing multiple degrees as well.
So, Doctor, as we sum up for a lot of our listeners here, in your best assessment, where should a patient maybe seek the services of an acupuncturist? In other words, where would the Eastern medicine approach best apply as a remedy to a particular medical condition?
Most patients who see acupuncturists probably fall into the category of what I call last resorters, that they've tried everything else, nothing else has worked, and they're willing to try acupuncture. And there's a good reason for that. The number two fear, again, depending on what study you look at in this country, is needles. So most people try to avoid needles. So it's a last resort.
They have
to be in a lot of pain before they go seek us out. It's the number two fear. So, and that's one of the reasons why I like to emphasize that acupuncture is only one of a couple dozen modalities that we do. And if you are afraid of needles, there's lots of other things we can do as well to help treat you, though needles are very effective. That's the biggest thing I get when I say I'm an acupuncturist. Not always, but often I will get, oh, I hate needles. I can never do that. But a lot of people say that, and then when they're in enough pain or discomfort, they'll try it. And so I think this idea of when should you try acupuncture, I'd love for everyone to go out and try acupuncture for anything. You have a cold, go give it a shot. But I think most people are likely to go to an acupuncturist when they've tried other things. They haven't helped. They're a little bit on the desperate side, and so they're willing to give it a shot. And that's okay. We're very good with that. The only caution I would have there is acupuncture, they're not voodoo. It's not magical. So it's not, just like in many, many medical conditions, you wouldn't go and expect it to be cured in one visit of the doctor. For acupuncture, you need to go on multiple visits. And my biggest advice to someone who's thinking about doing acupuncture is plan to go. I usually will, with patients, anywhere from maybe as low as 4, but usually 6 to 8 visits before you're going to see some significant results. You definitely would get some relief before that, but for the significant, long-lasting results, it's going to take at least 6 to 8 visits. And so if you think, oh, I'm going to give it a try and try it once, it's unlikely that you're going to get a lot of relief from that. So that would be my one caution. But I really do think that's a good answer to what you've said, is when should someone think about acupuncture when you've tried other things and it doesn't work?
Doctor, as we close, if our listeners would like to find out more about acupuncture, do you have a website or something where they can study or read it? Because maybe they're in a situation in their life right now. They've got chronic pain. They don't want to be stuck on pain pills, pain meds. Maybe they have an autoimmune disease. They have back pain. You know, for me, I did exactly what you just described. I was going to traditional Western medicine for lower back pain because of an injury. It wasn't working. I went to a chiropractor and eventually with an acupuncture, and then went to a stretch machine and it's gone. I don't have that problem anymore. But I had to go through that cycle of saying, this isn't working, this isn't working. Oh, this works. And problem resolved.
Very, very typical. There's a whole bunch of resources out there. I would be remiss if I didn't send you to our school's website. Our school does have a newsletter and does have a lot of information on its website. And that's stuhs.edu. So www.stuhs.edu. That's the Southern California University of Health Sciences. If you are looking nationally at a potential resource, I'd probably put you to nccaom.org, and that's the National Certification Commission of Acupuncture and Oriental Medicine. So the nccaom.org. They are, for most states, about 45 of the 50 states, they are the licensing exam. It's technically a certification exam, but you can't get licensed without going through their exam. If you're in California, I would recommend the California State Oriental Medical Association website, which is CSOMA, C-S-O-M-A, online.org.
If they just Google acupuncture, would a lot of these things come up on Google?
Possibly, yes. Probably also a lot of ads for individual practitioners. And I think ultimately, it's not a bad idea to just go talk to an individual practitioner about your issue and your concerns, and certainly call them up. And just like any medical practitioner, I'd recommend interviewing, if not them, their staff, and look at their website. And I'm a firm believer in the rule of 80-20, which means 20% of any profession are very good at what they do, and the 80% may not be so. So ask around and get some questions, and don't just go to the one that's on the corner next to you, because just like anyone else, they may not be the best practitioner for you. And there are specialties. There are people in acupuncture that really do specialize. So, you know, you don't want to go to a fertility acupuncturist for your low back pain. So ask around and ask some questions.
Well, listen, Doctor, I want to thank you for joining us on Lifetime Income. Very helpful and useful information. And I wanted to get that out there, because when people get to retirement, two of the big things on their minds is their health and their money. And we try to cover the health issues from a broad perspective here. And thank you for adding a new dimension here.
Thank you very much. It was my pleasure. And I would just like to add that there are many conditions. Studies have shown that it's actually less expensive to use acupuncture than it is to go the traditional route. And low back pain might be one of those.
Well, worked for me, and it was less expensive. Well, listen, Doctor, thanks for joining us on Lifetime Income. All the best to you, and don't be a stranger. Come back and talk to us again.
Would love to. Thank you very much.
Well, that concludes this week's Lifetime Income series. I had Dr. Sperber on here because we've had some requests. As you know, we've covered different forms of diets, different forms of treatments, and what we try to do is just get the information out there for you. So hopefully you found this a little bit different. I know in my own case, I injured myself doing some advanced Pilates a number of years ago and developed a sciatica condition as a result of it. I went through traditional Western medicine, seeing an orthopedic doctor. That didn't work. Chiropractor helped, and eventually it was acupuncture, and then special stretches I learned to do got rid of the problem. So anyway, I hope you found it helpful. In the meantime, well, as always, we're out of time. On behalf of John Leffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on Lifetime Income. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant week.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries, or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.